This is a Stimulus Network podcast.
The Cosmic Shed.
Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. In today's episode, we're speaking to Manu Saadia, who wrote the book Trekonomics, or Exploring the Economics of Star Trek. But it's not as boring as you might think. In fact, it's absolutely fascinating. And the reason we did it is because the book is brilliant, but also because recently I was watching the past tense double episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And, well, here's a clip from it, and I'll let you see if you can work out why I thought this was particularly timely. Just before we go into it, the episodes see the Deep Space Nine crew travel back in time to just a few years into our future.
Look at this man. There's no need for him to live like that. With the right medication, he could lead a full and normal life.
Maybe in our time.
Not just in our time. There are any number of effective treatments for schizophrenia, even in this day and age. They could cure that man now, today, if they gave a damn.
It's not that they don't give a damn. They've just given up. The social problems they face seem too enormous to deal with.
That only makes things worse. Causing people to suffer because you hate them is terrible. But causing people to suffer because you have forgotten how to care, it's really hard to understand.
They'll remember. It will take some time and it won't be easy. But eventually people in this century will remember how to care.
Before we get into that interview that Ty and I did with Manu, I'm delighted to announce the winners of our From the Earth to the Moon Blu-ray competition. The wonderful people at HBO UK provided us with four Blu-rays to give away to our followers on Twitter and Facebook, which is, of course, at The Cosmic Shed and The Cosmic Shed on Facebook. And the winners are from Facebook, Stuart Holmes and Gethin Wilkinson. And from Twitter, it's Amy Barrett and Mark Pitty. I've struck up a bit of a conversation with Amy and Mark, and Amy actually works for Science Focus magazine, which is a wonderful magazine, which is also produced here in Bristol. And Mark actually produces his own film podcast called Don't Think About Elephants. See, after you've heard this interview with Manu Saadia, then do go pick up a copy of Science Focus and download an episode or two of Don't Think About Elephants. Here's Manu Saadia, and we began by asking him how and why he thought he'd write a book about the economics of Star Trek.
We moved to a new neighborhood, and it turns out like our neighbor two houses down used to write on Star Trek. Like he was an executive producer and writer on Star Trek Enterprise. And, okay. You know, it's L.A., so this is not uncommon at all that you will, you know, end up bumping into people who work in TV. And so we were having a few beers and I was looking at his collection of Star Trek, you know, books and stuff, because a lot of Star Trek writers are also Star Trek fans and they're very serious about it. And so we're like, wait, so you have like the philosophy of Star Trek and this and that and the other. Where's the economics? Because it's like the most important part. He's like, really? Is that? I was like, hell yeah. And so he's like, why don't you write the book? And so it was kind of on a dare. And so I did it. Okay. And the great part was it turned out through people I know. So I got Paul Krugman to read the manuscript and he gave me notes. So that was weird. you know, and that's, yeah. So I studied economic history. So, and I remember in grad school, that was one of our main late night conversation was, you know, the nature and the structure of the economics of the Federation. That was like something that we really seriously engaged about. So in a way, the book, I had been writing it for a while, in my head at least, you know, my head canon. So yeah, that's why I did it. And I'm very surprised that, you know, it got the kind of reception that it got, and that, you know, a lot of fans like me have read it. So I'm sort of, this is very gratifying.
So you're a fan going back to your childhood?
Yes. And, you know, in France, it was, so I grew up in France. And the first time I saw anything related to Star Trek was in like 1980 when the motion picture came out. And in France, at least, it was never that popular. And it never had the kind of currency or the kind of impact and place in the culture that it has in America. I wonder about England. I mean, I know in England there's a long tradition of science fiction on TV as well. And I guess importing stuff from America is more common. In France, Star Trek was never, it was never the thing that people would do. You know, I've heard from fans that, you know, they would run from school at 5 p.m. to catch the reruns. That's not at all what would happen in France. In France, for all I know, in the 80s, science fiction was really not something that serious people read or engage about or you know, wait for on TV or in the movie theater.
Has that changed?
Yes, to an extent. And I think that has to do with culture has become much more fragmented, and I suppose there are so many niches and it's very easy to find your own thing. So in France now, science fiction is much more accepted and acceptable. I mean, I just read that Claire Denis, the great filmmaker, just made a science fiction movie. So that, like, it's becoming even, you know, something that hipsters and serious, you know, indie filmmakers, auteurs are doing. So, yes, but, you know, unfortunately, I don't live in France anymore. So what do I know?
Let's get down into the nitty gritty of the Trekonomics, if you will.
Yes.
So, I mean, in Star Trek, Captain Picard famously said,
"The acquisition of wealth is no longer the driving force in our lives. We work to better ourselves and the rest of humanity."
Which sounds wonderful. I mean, that is the entire ethos of Star Trek. How do you think humanity gets there from here, at where we are now in 2019, to, in Star Trek lore, World War III, to a moneyless utopia where we're all trying to better ourselves? How can you see that history going?
How do we get to Star Trek? I have no idea. When you read Keynes from 1931, The Economic Prospects for Our Grandchildren, he mentions that, you know, the GDP of England will multiply by 4 in 100 years. So we're almost there, and that has happened. And he also mentions that by then, society as a whole will be so wealthy that people will not need to toil as much. He's talking about a 3-hour workday. And that hasn't happened, even though society has become so much more wealthy as a whole. You know, I'm not talking about inequality. So I think the question that we have to ask ourselves in the real world is greed, or the kind of motivation that is provided by market forces, necessary to increase living standards? So that's one. And that's a tough question. And it seems that it's working that way right now. But we also know that publicly funded investment in technology are crucial to make that happen. For instance, you would not have Uber or Lyft if you did not have the public maintenance. First of all, the public investment and then maintenance of the GPS system. So that's one thing. Then there is something about human nature, and I'm very loath to use that term because I don't know what it is. But it seems, no, I mean, you know, it's something that's not fixed. And when it comes to economic behavior, it's fairly complicated, because it seems that we live in a society where our proclivities to accumulate things and our desires to signal our status through the acquisition of things is not only the norm, but also rewarded. Consumer society functions on this idea that we're going to sell you all sorts of goods that are not necessarily needs, but that perform a function that is more cultural, that has to do with, you know, keeping up with the Joneses. And a lot of our lives revolve around making money so that we will be able to get the next cool album, or the next cool, you know, branded t-shirt, or the next cool branded this or that. And that hasn't changed. And people have not become stoic, and people have not abandon their attraction to signaling and to conspicuous consumption. Mm-hmm. So that's where Keynes seems to have erred. Maybe we could have a three-hour work week and live simply, but maybe we don't want to, collectively. Yeah. I don't know.
The interesting politics of Star Trek is that essentially it is a democratic socialist world. I mean, there is a president of the Federation.
Yes.
There's like a, the Federation Council is like a United Nations. And Star Trek's even done a more extreme socialist utopia in the form of the Borg.
Seven of Nine.
Yes.
What will happen now?
We will engage the Borg.
Will Voyager be destroyed?
The Borg are powerful, but Captain Janeway is a resourceful leader. We will resist.
Resistance is futile.
Perhaps.
That is the extreme end of socialism. You have the Borg, but in the world of the Federation, everything is democratically done. There's also a level of meritocracy in that you're working to be the best of the best by enrolling in Starfleet. How today, obviously, capitalism is a big part of the Western world, especially in America. Mm-hmm. But there is seeming to be a rise in or a return in democratic socialism. People look to Norway. Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are big supporters of socialism. Do you see that more utopian vision of socialism coming into play these days? Or do you think that fear of socialism is still coming into play?
The fear of the S word, I mean, you know, this is, I mean, but this is very American. Like, it's very strange to live in America in that sense, because whatever they call socialism, you know, the right wing calls socialism like, ooh, to us Europeans, it's like, eh. I mean, you know, Bernie Sanders, you know, when you look at the platform, you know, it's fairly moderate, run-of-the-mill Fabian society. I mean, like, there's nothing really radical about it. But in America, of course, that's much more, I mean, it's used as a cudgel. I think Star Trek has played a role in that, because Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but also, you know, people like Stacey Abrams, a lot of American, young American politicians grew up watching The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine. And what they got out of it was not the technology, but was the fact that, yes, it is actually possible to live in a kind of society that promotes equality and justice.
Poverty was eliminated on Earth a long time ago, and a lot of other things disappeared with it. Hopelessness, despair, cruelty.
Young lady, I come from a time when men achieved power and wealth by standing on the backs of the poor, where prejudice and intolerance are commonplace and power is an end unto itself. And you're telling me that isn't how it is anymore?
That's right.
Maybe. It's worth giving up cigars for, after all.
America had a, you know, very strong socialist tradition. The IWW and you know, Eugene V. Debs in the early 20th century, they all get killed, so or put in jail. I mean, that's how they dealt with it. That's, you know, that's America. I hope that we move on to something a little more humane, I would say. To be honest, it's a multi-year, you know, generational fight. And I think that, for instance, Piketty's book made a huge splash in America, the capital in the 21st century. This discussion, this historical discussion of how inequality accumulates, that has had a tremendous impact. And it's sort of a dividing line. And you still have people arguing, you know, and mostly on the right, that inequality is wonderful because it's a needle that motivates people. And you have people now who are starting to argue in good faith that maybe society should provide public goods and common goods and should manage the commons better. So hopefully we're going to have that discussion, and we're already having that discussion. I mean, I say we, and I feel always strange saying we, because I'm not an American citizen, and I don't vote in the U.S. So I, you know,
it's not your fault then.
Well, I mean, I live here, so I participate in this.
Yeah.
The weird thing about America is a lot of aspects of society are socialism. Everyone pays in for the military, the roads, you know, the police force, but it seems like healthcare is one step too far. And I think even Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has said that she is a big Star Trek fan. And a lot of that is where it comes from. We should totally get her on. The interesting thing, though, about Star Trek, which is the technology. Technology makes it so that no one really has to get paid in the form of replicators, because when you have replication technology that provides clothes, food, water for everyone, then people don't have to work for those items and they can give that time and effort to something else. Do you think if replication technology was to be created, society would naturally go that way? Or do you think it would compound the inequality that we see in the world?
I'm going to use an example from Star Trek itself. The Ferengis, so the capitalists of the galaxy, the Americans, you know.
Yeah.
The rules of acquisition say expand or die.
Rules of acquisition?
That's rule number 45. I've memorized all 173, including the most important one. A man is only worth the sum of his possessions.
Back on my homeworld, that kind of thinking almost destroyed our civilization.
You should have managed your businesses better.
They use the replicator and they make you pay for it.
Yeah.
You know, so if they make you pay for it, then what good is it? It's just another machine making stuff, and probably allows you to displace workers. So it's interesting that in the world of Star Trek itself, you have on the one hand a civilization that makes you pay for the replicator and a civilization that doesn't make you pay for the replicator, and that's the Federation. So it seems that at some point in the world of Star Trek, a decision was made to make the replicator a public good. And that's a political decision. And that's a collective political decision. And that is something that maybe shows us the way, or at least the way the writers think about it in Star Trek, which is it has to be a political decision. Technology itself can be used in many ways. I'm not a technological determinist, to use complicated terms. Yeah. I believe that, you know, technology is only as good as the usage we put it to, which, by the way, means that in the world of Star Trek, when they made the decision to turn the replicators into public goods, they were already there in terms of how you deal with the production of goods and the distribution of wealth. Yeah. So we don't have a good explanation. At some point, you know, in the history of Star Trek, fictional history, they say that, you know, the Vulcans and money went the way of the dinosaurs and the new economics, and that's it. And boom. And which is also problematic. I mean, it's problematic. It's a bit inconsistent in the canon because, as you see, you mentioned, you know, there are politicians in Star Trek. But what is the meaning of politics when the debates are no longer about the allocation of resources? Because most politics is about conflict on the allocation of resources in society. So that's no longer the case in Star Trek. So what is politics about? I wonder. It's about diplomacy, maybe. Whatever, if we ever come to the point where we have a universal replication technology of one sort or another, when human labor is no longer needed to produce goods, we'll still have to make the decision about how to distribute the benefits of that.
Yeah, because it's kind of one, the argument against a moneyless system is that money's just something that we use to barter with, and if you just remove that, it's not going to change who we are. It's not going to make us better people. We're just going to use something else to argue about and barter with. Is that true?
Well, I mean, if you're in a situation where most stuff is available for free in unlimited amounts, then the value of goods will converge to zero. So the use of currency to barter will be limited to areas probably where the value is not converging to zero, and that's very, it's immaterial stuff. Maybe, I wonder. It's not entirely clear. And also you have to remember, you need to use, even if you're in a society like Star Trek that has infinite resources, you still need to use some kind of unit of account to keep track of things and plan and coordinate. So
yeah.
Will we live in a society without currency at some point? If you look at us today, there are already a lot of areas of social life where money is not used, and the non-market side of our social life still exists, contrary to what people say. And that's a good thing. And I think if we can slowly reduce the market sector to, you know, a few things, I think this is a realistic way to get there. That's the, you know, wolf in sheep's clothing. I've been reading about the Fabian society a lot these days, so I'm sort of, you know, like that's it's a realistic approach, I think.
Those comm panels are for official ship business. Well, if they're so important, why don't they need an executive key? Aboard a starship vessel, that is not necessary. We are all capable of exercising self-discipline now. You will refrain from using them.
If the Borg are extreme socialism, or the far left of socialism, and the Federation is just socialism, and somewhere in between it you get 7 of 9, then I'm kind of okay with that.
It's funny because since this is LA, our kids used to go to school with her kids, so.
It's, oh, really? It's,
yeah.
Excuse us.
Stand aside.
Thank you.
Yeah, no comment. Wonderful, wonderful lady.
Obviously, the heroes that we see in Star Trek, they are the best of the best. They are essentially the 1%. They're on the flagship. But Star Trek hints at a lot of people within the Federation that do hard labor and are compensated for it. For example, there are dilithium miners that do hard graft to get the dilithium crystals that power starships, and as a result, are very rich and own their own moons. So there is clearly kind of like a guild of people that, like Saudi Arabia, that own a lot of power within the
Sea. Wait. Is that in the Federation itself? I mean, I remember Ferengis owning their own moons.
I'm remembering the original series episode of Mudd's Women, where Harry Mudd's selling these women to dilithium miners who are all meant to be very rich, despite the fact that they all look like they've not washed for several months.
The original series was not the fully realized version.
That is true.
I mean, you know, they still use credits, and they're not entirely clear on, you know, how the whole thing works. There's a real epistemic break between the original series and the Next Generation in that regards, I think. And even the dilithium itself, like, it sounds really strange that they would not have found a substitute at that point. But it's true nonetheless that the people that we see on the show are the only ones who are interesting in that society, in the sense that, you know, they have adventures and stuff. And my theory is that the people you see in Starfleet are the ones who cannot deal, like, they're the maladapted ones. They're the psychopaths. They're the excited people. Like just put them on a starship, go somewhere. You know, like, but imagine you live in a society that's with overabundance, and you're free to do anything in the world, and even nothing if you want to. And you would go on a tin can and on a starship with like military ranks and stuff. Like, why would you do that? You have to be nuts.
I think you're right there. Actually, thinking about it, whenever they portray Earth, apart from when, you know, stuff comes from the sky.
Yes.
It's a very nice, peaceful place to be, isn't it? It's
kind of. But I mean, at the same time, you have people like Benjamin Sisko's father owns a restaurant in New Orleans. So day after day, he is cooking and running a restaurant, and people are coming in. And I'm assuming they're eating for free and leaving, and he seems to be loving it.
Yes.
But again, all these people could probably eat for free at home with the replicators. But what they're doing is they're coming out and trying authentic New Orleans food. And he is just happy to do that all day, every day for the rest of his life.
It's about the craft. It's about the deepening of the craft as almost as a form of meditation or self-realization. It's you spend 10, 20, 30 years, your entire life, like trying to make the souffle rise. this is a society where people are free to, you know, spend 30 years exploring how to make the best souffle. This is kind of cool. And Cisco's dad seems like more normal than the captain. I mean,
yeah.
I would almost say more interesting. I'd be more interested in spending time with, you know, the restaurateur who spends 30 years trying to make the best souffle than with the captain who's just, you know, like a glorified firefighter. I you know, respect to Captain Cisco. Tremendous respect. But I think Starfleet is what is the most relatable to us today. And you know, it's TV, you have to have drama. So you have to have crazy, yeah. You have to have crazy people who are sort of kind of similar to us. It's like The Next Generation. You know, it's a workplace show where a workplace drama where there's no real drama and it's hardly a workplace. And that's kind of, I mean, it's complicated to show that on TV day, you know, every week for 24 weeks a year. Like, you have to find stories.
It's interesting because that all of that kind of stuff would work on the Enterprise and on Earth, the getting what you want and eat to drink for free. But I've always wondered how that works on Deep Space Nine, because that is, it's a Federation outpost. But people aren't eating and drinking for free in Quarks. They're not eating and drinking for free in the Klingon restaurant. So where are the Starfleet officers getting the money or the credit to pay for their time in the holosuite? Are they flogging their items in their quarters? Where are they getting the money from to essentially gambo on the Darbo tables? Basically, is everyone on Deep Space Nine bankrupt somehow? Have they just racked up massive debts?
No, I mean,
no
remember,
intention of paying it back.
But remember, the Federation is the wealthiest and is infinitely wealthy in the galaxy. So chances are they do have foreign currency accounts for these kind of situations that are bottomless pits. And the officers who have to interact with other civilizations have access to the foreign currency accounts. They tend to look at it as almost like a quaint game. And it's funny to them. It's funny money. In Deep Space Nine, they mention that there is a bank that's part of the Federation, the Bank of Bolyas. So they do have a way to trade in currency with other countries or powers or, you know, yes, civilizations. They don't use it inside. I believe the Soviet Union had some kind of similar setup where they were very hungry for foreign currency, but the ruble itself inside the Soviet Union was not convertible. And I think China used the same type of stuff. I mean, I'm not saying that Star Trek is like the Soviet Union, far from it, like kind of the opposite, but there is a way to make this work. And it seems that that's what it is. It doesn't seem though, you know, like on Deep Space Nine, you don't see the officers getting really, worked up about how much they spend or budgeting or saving money for retirement. Like, they don't care. They don't give a crap. It's just funny. So that's how I explain it. It seems that this tracks with what you see on the show. And what we know of Deep Space Nine is that the producers and the writers were really trying to work against the sort of, we're no longer acquisitive, we don't care about this stuff. They've been on the record saying that they found the structure of the Star Trek universe extremely limiting in the kind of stories you could tell. And Deep Space Nine kind of works because of that tension, I think, because you see the utopian society in constant contact and conflict with others that are less advanced. And you know, and in the end, the Ferengis become Democrat socialists. So this is This is wonderful.
I think that's why I always like Deep Space Nine, because you got to see Starfleet through the eyes of the Cardassians, who just view it as nicey-nicey. The Ferengis just think they're insidious.
Yes.
Major Kira has incredible issues with how Starfleet's run and the bureaucracy of it all. And it's also the place where you get to see the underbelly of that utopia. So in the next generation, crime with con artists like Vash, they're all about stealing antiques that are unique. And then when you see the Orion Syndicate, they're all into slavery and manipulating politicians. So it's not so much as about wealth, but as about power.
The galaxy is not a nice place. It's dangerous out there. That's true. I mean, the Federation, they even in the Federation, I think they do have, especially in Starfleet, you always have like those shady admirals who are like running weird, their weird agendas on their own. Like there seems to be a lot of fights and power struggles inside of Starfleet itself. Power and recognition. And that seems to be the thing that motivates people to act the way they act on the show. If you strip away the material interests, then, you know, you still have people who are hungry for power and scheming and bad. There are a lot of bad people inside of Starfleet.
The other thing that they do to create drama is to have the mirror universe, right? Because that's that's all the bad guys. And I'm just thinking about this idea of sending the psychopaths off into space. But can we send them into the mirror universe? And like can we just take politics just for the sake of argument? Obama was the Starfleet, and then you've got the mirror universe version of Obama in power now. I mean, that's kind of works, doesn't it? Could we not just send all of that sort of person?
No, we can't.
Oh.
prime directive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, you're right, though, about why would anyone want to join Starfleet? If you could spend your entire life on Earth painting or...
On Risa.
Why would you want to join Starfleet and run the risk of being a sanitation engineer Deep Space Five or whatever? It's crazy. But at the same time, the bureaucracy of Star Trek fascinates me, because you obviously have a UN-like system with the United Federation of Planets. How is anything done when it comes to allocating resources for building fleets of starships or helping out other worlds? Because obviously more cultures are going to bring more to the table than others. So can you, and not everyone's going to not have the no money policy that Earth and Vulcan do. So do you think every culture that enters Starfleet or the Federation has to give up money?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
And I think how else otherwise? They have to be brought up to speed quickly. I mean, maybe there are associate members, you know, a little bit like the EU, where you have the associate members. England is becoming an associate member. I think, you know, Starfleet is more like the EU in a way. You know, it's very mysterious, and the Federation is. It's very mysterious how things work at the center. But somehow they manage to make things work seamlessly. The bureaucracy is probably, I mean, it's got to be so enormous. It's hilarious. But,
I can't see them making an entire series about the 3 years of negotiations to try and leave the Federation. I mean, that would be really boring.
Andoria wants to leave for some reason.
Oh my God, that would be excellent.
One of the founding members of the Federation suddenly wants out.
How do you call it? Fexit? Fexit? No, I mean, but that would be a good, that's a good pitch. That's a good pitch. And like, it's the Romulans underneath that are manipulating the whole thing to make Andoria leave. to go back to that question of how does power work in the Federation and bureaucracy, I think it's fascinating because you have the Borg being the mirror image of it. So the Borg, they have no bureaucracy because they basically have the command and control lodged in everybody's brains. So the problem of coordination is completely solved in the Borg. Everybody's so wired to each other in the network.
Fascinating. The Borg group consciousness is divided into sub-commands necessary to carry out all functions. Defense, communication, navigation. They are all controlled by a root command implanted into each.
In the Federation, it's not quite like that. So how do you plan for stuff? Do you need to plan if you have unlimited resources, though? You probably don't, because nobody's going to compete for resources. I mean, you might compete for human resources. The best starship engineer, for instance. But yeah. Again, they have all these computers and robots. I mean, they don't have many data, but they have all these computers. Like, how many engineers are really needed, in fact, to solve problems?
Well, I think that's all about the whole meritocracy of Starfleet. Everyone's trying to strive to be the one to serve on the Enterprise. And every now and then you'll get a Lieutenant Barclay who's just happy to be wherever. He's happy just coasting along. He'll work on any starship. Not everyone wants to be the best of the best, which I like. Those characters are more interesting. Your Lieutenant Barclays, your Ensign Rose, the ones who are kind of like, fuck you all. I'll just do what I really want to do, which is...
I mean, my favorite episode in all of Next Generation is Lower Decks.
I just got promoted.
Congratulations.
Thanks. Just doesn't feel right. For all I know, she was going to get the promotion instead of me.
You shouldn't feel that way, Sam.
She would have been happy for you, Sam.
The best way to remember her would be to excel in your new position.
Because it's like, okay, you see the underbelly and you see like the earnest young officers trying to ingratiate themselves to Riker. And I mean, it's a little bit like grad school, to be honest.
Yeah.
So I find that much more interesting. Apparently, they're doing
an entire.
I don't know how that's going to go, but that's interesting.
You a fan of Discovery?
Okay, look at it this way. They decided to go with the prequel.
Mm.
So we're not in the world of the 24th century utopia. And then, you know, it makes sense because you can tell more stories that are more dramatic as a result. And so it's better for TV and to attract viewers who are going to have to pay every month. So there's that.
Well, we get it on Netflix here, so we're okay.
That's right. But you still have to pay for Netflix.
That's true. Yeah.
And then
that is why I signed up for Netflix, because they put Star Trek on it. So yeah.
See? So there's that. And then they did not even attempt. Nobody has attempted to do something that's 200 years further down the road from, you know, the 24th century.
Well, you've got the Picard series coming out soon. That's going to be literally 20 years after Star Trek Nemesis. That would be interesting to see what take they've done on that.
I love Sir Patrick. He's an amazing actor. I love the character he depicts. I don't really see the point of a Picard series, but
ooh.
I'm good with what I have now. That's my stance on Star Trek. It's a body of work that's, you know, unique and self-contained. And what I look for in it is the work of utopia, which is something that you don't often see in science fiction, and you don't often see even in popular culture or in culture in general. Like, since the 19th century, have we had a lot of majorly popular, widespread, well-known narrative utopia? Have we had that? No, we only had Star Trek. And so that's what I seek in it. That's what I find in it. The sort of the proliferation of corporate fanfic, you know, it's not my I'm sure it's great, and I'm sure the craft is there, and they have Michael Chabon writing for the Picard series. Yeah. So I'm sure it's going to be great as an object of, you know, television narrative and drama. I have honestly zero interest in it. Zero.
So what do you look for as other science fiction for other things, or is your focus always on trying to find utopias?
No, I mean I grew up reading science fiction as a sort of way to escape from what was asked for me in French school, which is read Victor Hugo and Proust, yeah. which I did read and I enjoy as well. But I think there's something very useful in utopia, because also I'm a kind of a red diaper baby, so that's part of who I am. And there is utopia in science fiction. There is some, you know, the Strugatsky brothers, Ursula Le Guin, the Ian Banks. The great Ian Banks from England, Scotland, sorry.
All part of the same Europe.
true. We're yes. So I do. What I find strange, by the way, is that in the end, you'd think that science fiction would be the place to have a lot of utopian imagination. And strikingly not the case. Ian Banks or Le Guin or the Strugatsky brothers or some Asimov and Star Trek are basically pretty much it. There's none of the sort of the great H.G. Wells thrust to invent the next better world. Maybe there are very few. I mean, H.G. Wells was a notorious socialist. Maybe there are very few socialists who write science fiction. And I think this is something that's missing.
Yep.
Speaking about how economics works in science fiction, me and my wife have recently been rewatching the Ronald D. Moore Battlestar Galactica. Because she's married to me, she has to endure these kinds of discussions that I suddenly come out with at the dinner table. And I was like, how do the economies work with just 45,000 people left? You know, there's a black market episode, and then they're still having the quorum of 12 as if these colonies still exist. Why would it not be like the quorum of each ship? Because instead of colonies, it's now ships in the fleet. And I found that fascinating, how they stick to an economic and political system for such a small portion of the population when they've lost everything.
They hang on to it.
They hang on to it. It's the only thing they've got going on. They have to hold on to the traditions of their world.
It's almost like a cultural fixture that it's the last thing that they can hang on to is, it's an exceptional TV series. And Ronald Moore is just, you know, he's currently doing something for Apple TV. So.
Oh, is he?
Yes, I'm really looking forward. But then, you know, you're going to have to pay for another subscription to another service and stuff. Hanging on to traditions and practices of the past is something fascinating in that sense. And I think Battlestar Galactica, he was really trying to right the wrongs that he perceived in the way Star Trek portrayed the world. I mean, it's definitely in dialogue with that.
People know something has to be done. I mean, the world is fracked. It's upside down, and somebody's got to turn it right side up. Are you that man?
I'm one of them.
Personally, I really like Babylon 5. I mean, okay, people say the effects are clunky and all that, and it's a little bit cheesy, but I think there's something in there. First of all, it kind of invented the three-year narrative arc in TV, or in, well, I mean, along with Twin Peaks, I guess. And I think Babylon 5 is interesting in that. But it's, again, it's the kind of science fiction that talks about the present with costumes and aliens. And most science fiction is that. It's just talking about us. What I find remarkable in Next Generation in particular, but also in Deep Space Nine, is that the motivations and the behaviors of the characters do not rest on whatever assumptions we have about people today in the present. They're truly alien in the sense that they're our future selves, maybe, but they're truly alien. Like, you can't really understand their motivation if you don't take into account the fact that they live in a world where they don't need to work, or that where work is not compulsory. It's very much they live in Herbert Marcuse's world, or, you know, imagined world. It's not often said, but it seems that, you know, Gene Roddenberry and the people who conceived the Trek like that, like they had read One Dimensional Man. It's I don't see how they had not. You know, there's no more conspicuous consumption than alienation through consumption. It's no longer an issue.
If this future came about and you were alive in it, what would you do? Would you be a janitor on Deep Space Five? Would you be doing lectures in a room on the economics that used to be important in history?
I thought long and hard about this, and personally, if it were up to me, I would do nothing. I would do absolutely nothing. I would try to find a beach or a little volcano, like an interesting place in nature, and I would do nothing, and I would wait for death. But, you know, I would sit down and meditate and look at nature and do nothing.
Watch Star Trek.
No, I mean, not even. Not even.
Literally nothing.
Yes, I would try to find a way to do nothing and figure out, you know, can you do nothing, really? It's
but
a big
can
question.
You in that society? Because if everyone in society is trying to be the best possible version of themselves, would you be inspired to do that as well? Is it that preferred mentality? If you're living in a world of perfect people who are all trying to be the best possible versions of themselves.
But then again, you know, I think there would be tremendous value in excelling at the art of doing nothing. And I would try to be the person in the entire Federation who does nothing. And you know, I'm saying that in jest, but actually people would probably recognize that as this is his path. This is his path in life. This is his chosen path to wisdom.
I'm just thinking about the planet Earth and all the different species we have in it. And I reckon the one that I'd want to be most that doesn't have money is a whale, right?
Yes.
Just like to roam the oceans, doing nothing but opening my mouth and having lots of krill and then going...
And avoiding humans.
And yeah. I mean...
You know that whales, because of the frequency of their chants... Like it's been proven that the sounds can travel throughout the ocean, which is crazy. And they signal to each other like at extreme far distances. Like, don't come here. This is my place. Or, I mean, we haven't figured out what are the phonemes and what they mean, but it seems that there is a language going on there. And okay, maybe I wouldn't do nothing. Maybe I would try to figure that out, because that's interesting. Devoting oneself to the study of other cultures is something that takes you out of yourself. And I have a soft spot for anthropology, so maybe that's what I would do. And I think, you know, the natural extension of that is whales and dolphins and octopuses. I mean, like. Animal cultures must be very interesting. So
I've got a feeling what the whales are saying to each other is, have you seen that really weird film where there's that space human? And they get the signal from the space human, and it's really odd.
The whale version of the Fermi paradox, I'm trying to figure out what it is.
Spock, what do you make of that?
Most unusual. An unknown form of energy of great power and intelligence. Evidently unaware that its transmissions are destructive. I find it illogical that its intentions should be hostile.
Really? You think this is its way of saying hi there to the people of the Earth?
There are other forms of intelligence on Earth, Doctor. Only human arrogance would assume the message must be meant for man.
You're suggesting the transmission is meant for a life form... other than man?
At least a possibility, Admiral. The President did say it was directed at Earth's oceans.
Before we let you go, Manu, I've got kind of one question about where our history versus Star Trek history is going. So at the moment, it's 2019. Are you aware of what happens in 2020 and 2024 in Star Trek history?
The Bell Riots, correct?
The Bell Riots, exactly. So for people who aren't familiar with the Bell Riots, by 2020, the American government, reacting to serious problems of homelessness and unemployment, create special sanctuary districts, essentially walled off sections of the city grid in most major cities. Unfortunately, while established with the benevolent intent of providing free housing and food, as well as future employment, the sanctuaries quickly degenerate into inhumane internment camps for the poor, which led to the Bell Riots and lots of deaths. How far away are we from essentially the ghettoization of major cities, or are we right on schedule for the Bell Riots?
Yeah. What is happening at the border of wealthy countries? Like the real Bell Riots, it's the people dying in the Mediterranean on boats. That's that's the real Bell Riots. If I'm going to be honest, I think that's what we should look at. It's the way we are treating economic or, you know, war refugees from countries like Africa and the Middle East. That's the Bell Riots. That's the kid dying on the beach in you know, the kid washing off dead on the beach in Lesbos 2 years ago, 3 years ago.
What is this place?
Sanctuary district.
21st century history is not one of my strong points. Too depressing.
It's been a hobby of mine. They made some ugly mistakes, but they also paved the way for a lot of things we now take for granted.
I assume this is one of those mistakes.
A bad one. By the early 2020s, there was a place like this in every major city in the United States.
Why are these people in here? Are they criminals?
No, people with criminal records weren't allowed in the sanctuary districts.
Then what do they do to deserve this?
Nothing. Just people. Without jobs or places to live.
So they get put in here?
Welcome to the 21st century, Doctor.
Yeah.
Well, in the wake of the riots in the Star Trek lore, the United States finally begins to face its serious social problems that it struggled with for over a century. So maybe one day America will finally get to grips with its assorted social problems and something will be done. But on that note, we've got to let you go. So, Manny, can tell people where they can find you.
They can find the book on Amazon, I think. It's called Trekonomics. I'm on Twitter too much, and I'm at Trekonomics. Yeah, I'm trying to curb down because I'm writing a book. So
The Wrath of
Trekonomics? No. I've totally moved on. I'm trying. Yeah, they can find me on Twitter, and they can find the book on Amazon and various outlets. Thank you.
Brilliant. And we highly recommend picking up the book. It's a fantastic read. Manu, thank you so much for talking to us, and live long and prosper.
Live long and prosper. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much to Manu for talking to us, and thank you very much for listening. We'll be back very soon with another episode, which looks likely to be an interview with producer-director Lisa Downs, who's working on The Life After the Navigator, which is a documentary looking at, of course, the flight of the Navigator, and recently produced Life After Flash, which has just been released, which is, of course, all about Flash Gordon. So that's coming very soon, and thank you to all of you who entered our competition for the From the Earth to the Moon Blu-rays, and congratulations again to those winners. Oh, and before I go, we're about to announce TronFest. We're going to show both of the Tron films in a double bill. I'm going to get Pete Etchells in, who you'll know from our episode about being lost in a good game, to explore the science of computer games and all sorts of wonderful other things. You know how we work with these live shows. We'll see you there.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
This podcast is brought to you by the Stimulus Network.
You believe in the users?